Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is episode number 106 for Monday, February 20th, 2012. My name is Ben Stone, and we want to catch up on a couple things here before I get going into the main body of the podcast. First off, we had some listener mail that I haven't actually answered, and I'll give you the reason why. One was a request that we've had a couple times, and I've kind of wandered around it a little bit and haven't really answered it all that well, so I wanted to bring it up here on the podcast. It's a request for an archive where a single page, you could go to a single page on badquaker.com and find a list of the archive of all of the podcasts. It's really something we'd like to put together. We have just not gotten around to it. Possibly I'll do something like that, or and I need to work with our admin on that, and maybe we can get like a zip file, a single download of like 6 months worth or something along that lines. We have been talking about it, but we just haven't actually put it together and done it. But I do see your requests for that. And the reason I haven't answered is because I really don't have an answer yet, but that's definitely something we want to do. On another email that I didn't answer, came to me from a person in Australia, and the reason I didn't answer it was because I was looking at the return address that was listed, and it appeared to be one of those kind of bounce back mailboxes that is not necessarily it's kind of anyway. So it didn't look like I could mail back to that mailbox. However, what the point of the email was pointing me towards some specific software in regards to, I did a podcast the other day about like a form of underground banking, and specifically they have a form of this in Australia, and they have it in several other places as well. And I was talking about how possibly coin dealers or someone like that could act as a sort of a virtual bank, but not really involved, legally speaking, not really involved in banking. And as the Liberty Movement needed, we could utilize something like that to move funding around without with it being under the radar, so to speak. And so I appreciate the email with the links it didn't actually have links. It had some keywords that I could look up, and I did that, and I found some things. So I appreciate that. I know that sounds a little vague to anybody who doesn't know what I'm talking about, but that's okay. So okay, and now our big news is that we've got some switching up things here. If you notice on the website, I'll just kind of give you a history. We had, when we very first started BadQuaker.com a year ago, we had an initial donation of cash that a very kind person gave us as seed money to get the whole mess going. And then we had a different individual that volunteered her time and helped us get the website set up in its basic form so that we could get it up and running and broadcasting and so forth. Then we didn't have any method of donation, or we didn't ask for any donations or anything like that for quite some time. Now, I did have, if you've been to badquaker.com, you'll notice on the right-hand side there was a link to survival gear bags. And that was more as a favor to my friend Kelly that runs Survival Gear Bags than anything else, because Kelly is just a great guy. And I thought, well, if I can send some business in his direction, then I'll do it. That, that would be a nice thing to do for Kelly. But there wasn't actually any money exchanging hands in that. I was just doing something nice for him. Kelly has helped me in the past, so it was just kind of like that. And, the fact that Kelly is he's a good guy. He adheres to the non-aggression principle. He keeps his business very ethical and according to the non-aggression principle. And so, it was just my way of supporting a friend. But as far as actually receiving money, we didn't have any real way to do that with BadQuaker.com for quite some time, and then it started getting close to the time that we were going to need to renew the website and everything, and we were getting more and more listeners. So we went ahead and hooked up a PayPal button, and for a while I even tried Bitcoins, but I couldn't really figure out how to make it all work. But as simple as it seemed, and that's probably just me, but anyway, so we hooked up a PayPal, and almost immediately people started donating through PayPal, and very quickly we got more than enough money to both pay for another year of badquaker.com for the hosting and for the domain name renewal, and we were also able to upgrade our sound equipment, so I appreciate that greatly. But at the same time, it was kind of awkward for me mentioning donations. It's very awkward for me, and it was kind of awkward having even the button there to ask for donations. It just didn't, there's nothing, you know, morally wrong with it or anything like that. I just felt weird about it. So what we're looking at now, and you're going to hear this later on in the podcast today, we actually have arranged a real live sponsorship with real live merchants. And what we did with our old friends over there, Kelly at Survival Gear Bags, Kelly has actually purchased a commercial slot on badquaker.com. And in addition to Kelly, the good folks at Shire Silver have also made the same arrangement. So roughly midway in the podcast today, you're going to hear our new commercial for Survival Gear Bags and our new commercial for Shire Silver. So be sure and listen for that. That'll happen here in just a little while. Okay, now the other thing I wanted to update you on, since we are expanding our listening base, we struggled along with 40 or 50 listeners at first, and then pretty soon we were really amazed when we were over 500 regular daily downloads. We were pretty shocked about that. And then we got to 1,000 daily downloads, and we were very, very excited. And by about September of last year, we were over 1,000 downloads a day of the podcast, and we were very excited about that. Now, coming into the new year, by mid-December, we were already breaking over 2,000 downloads a day, and now we're probably close to 2,500 a day. So it's continuing to expand and catch on, and I really appreciate the listeners for sharing it with other people, because really that's the biggest way that the podcast is caught on. We have listeners over at the Liberty Radio Network, that's at lrn.fm, and hooking up with them in December helped also get the word out about badquaker.com. But I believe mostly the credit for the expansion of our listenership has come by way of the listeners, of them sharing the podcast with other people. And so I really appreciate that. Now, what we're looking at doing, and this is not an absolute, we're not locked into this just yet, but we are looking at the possibility of changing the format just a little and going to a more traditional radio-style podcast than the just the open. Because in the past, either if it was just me talking or if it was Kai and myself here, we would just pretty much hammer out 1 hour straight of nonstop whatever it is we do. But that's not really, that doesn't work very well with a radio format where they have to interrupt you every 15 minutes with all their advertising. And we're not real wild about having a lot of advertising either way. We're not doing this to make money or get rich or anything. If we can keep the site paid for, then we're going to just be thrilled, And if we can afford to improve our equipment and maybe expand through either advertising or through other methods like radio, then that'll be great too. But again, we're not here to try to make a lot of money or anything, or not trying to make any money. We're just really trying to express how important these things, these concepts and so forth are, of the zero aggression principle and so forth. So we may be playing around with more of a radio format where we do 15-minute chunks, and then we break for a second, and then do another 15-minute chunk, and in that sense, it'll make it a lot easier to convert it into a radio format if we choose to go in that direction. And what we're actually talking about is a low power radio station here locally where we broadcast from. And then Kai, her residence is about, 15 miles away or so. So we've even kicked around the idea that if we put two low-power radio stations that close together on the same frequency, we can take up a pretty good size chunk of it's a pretty well-populated area in that stretch there. Plus, it's on a major north-south artery on Highway 75. So we're kicking around these things. Who knows what'll come of it? Maybe we'll do something. Maybe we won't. So if you notice the format changing slightly, that's what's going on. Now, another thing I wanted to tell you about, and this is pretty exciting, really. I've been talking with Don Meishausen, who was one of the original founders of what's considered the modern libertarian movement. We're talking back in the late 60s. He was one of the real foundational people that really got the thing off its feet and got it going. And I spent probably 2.5 hours or so on the phone talking to him yesterday, just kind of getting caught up on everything and going through what's been going on in his life and everything. He's got just an amazing story to tell. I'm doing all I can to try to maybe put together an interview with him. I'm not sure when that'll happen. Hopefully sometime this coming week, or possibly, I don't know, maybe even tonight. Who knows? As soon as I can really arrange something with him where he's comfortable with it and we can fit it in scheduling and everything, I want to get Don on the podcast and let him tell you about his amazing life and some of the things that he's seen and been involved in over the years. He was, just to give you sort of a tease, when he was 19, he was testifying before Congress. He had been a sort of a mole or an infiltrator into a suspected communist organization. And if we do the interview, I'll read the beginning of his testimony before Congress for you. It's just amazing. A 19-year-old kid standing in front of Congress saying these things. It's just wild. He was, if you've read Brian Doherty's book, Radicals for Capitalism, A Freewheeling History of the Modern American Libertarian Movement, Brian talks about him in that book, being a major part of the history of the libertarian movement. If you're familiar with the famous 1968? I believe it was 1968, a famous incident where the Young Americans for Freedom organized a sort of a mass demonstration where one of the individuals publicly burned his draft card, and then about 300 of them walked out, 300 of the libertarians representing that group, walked out of the convention and in protest. And that was kind of like, that was, even though the Libertarian Party was officially formed in 1971 at David Nolan's house in Colorado, that incident with the Young Americans for Liberty, Young Americans for Freedom, was in many ways the real birth of the libertarian movement. Not so much as the actual party, but it was a sort of the first real solidified joint action of a lot of libertarians at the same place in the same time making a public statement like that. It was quite foundational, and Don was one of the three main people that arranged and pulled that little trick, pulled it off, and made it a success. So, like I say, if schedules can be worked out, and if I can, if Don will agree to it, I'm going to really try this week to get him on the podcast and let him talk to you about his amazing life. Now, in addition to that, I want to let you know that we're going to continue the series. I'm just doing this one. I'm going to continue the series on the inevitability of the police state. There's more episodes of that on the way, and there are more episodes that Kai and I are going to do on raising a nonviolent family. We have at least a couple more episodes of that one as well. So that was a lot of just kind of an update to let all the listeners know what's going on, and maybe give kind of a overview to some of the newer listeners. BadQuaker.com, the purpose of the podcast and the purpose of the website is exploring the zero aggression principle and how it interacts with our lives and how it can make just a better life on an individual basis and on a societal basis as well. And in that frame of thinking, I wanted to read Selene's Law for you. Now, I've read this before on the podcast, but I wanted to bring it back up again. It's been a while since I've gone over this. Selene's Law comes to us from the Illuminati Papers by Robert Anton Wilson. And it's been called a fairy tale for paranoids. That's, I think they meant that in an insultive fashion, but I kind of think it's pretty cool. Now, so there are these three laws in Selene's Laws. The first one is, well, I'll tell you what, I'll do it like this. I'll read the three laws and then I'll give an explanation. So, law number one, national security is the chief cause of national insecurity. Law number two, accurate communication is possible only in a non-punishing situation. And law number three, an honest politician is a national calamity. All right, now let me kind of give you an idea where this is coming from. Let's go back to number one. National security is the chief cause of national insecurity. This is sort of a modified version of what's stated in Wikipedia, although I played with it a little bit here. So, to have national security, one must create a secret police, since internal revolutionaries and external foes would make the secret police a prime target for infiltration, and because the secret police would, by necessity, have powers to blackmail and intimidate other members of the government. Another higher set of secret police must be created to monitor the secret police, and an even higher set of secret police must then be created to monitor the higher order of secret police. Repeat ad nauseum. Now, let's think about that just for a second. In the U.S., first the Treasury Department began attempting to get into law enforcement, and they failed utterly. And so the FBI was formed in the days when it was absolutely necessary that we have an FBI. And of course, why was this? Well, it was because there had been this massive amount of crime created by the prohibition of alcohol. And with crime came the violence. And when prohibition was stopped, you already had the network of crime gangs in place that the prohibition had created. So you had this necessity, supposedly, for the FBI. And at first, the FBI were a toothless lion. They were not allowed to carry weapons. They had to work with local agencies and so forth. But as time progressed, the FBI became more and more oppressive and more incompetent. Until eventually in the 1950s, the FBI was forced to publicly admit that they had been wrong or lying for years, that there actually was a mafia. They had to admit this when a mafia member turned and came out in the open and testified that there was indeed a mafia. And so the FBI was forced to admit that the mafia existed. Now, at the same time, the CIA, well, not the same exact time, but roughly in the same time frames, the CIA came out of previous secret agencies, and they were very important because we had a war going on, and then there was the Cold War, and we needed the CIA for our own safety. And pretty soon, then we have one agency after the other, and they're all double-checking on things, and they're all crisscrossing each other's activities. But they're not actually stopping. They're not doing what it is that we're told that they're supposed to be doing. The level of incompetency grows worse and worse as the agencies get bloated bigger and bigger. And then we start adding more agencies on into it, like the DEA and the BATF. And the BATF itself, the letters just keep expanding so that it's, you know, further and further, the agency just keeps growing on and on. And then we find out that these agencies are incapable of catching the attackers from the 9/11 incident. And so what do we need? Well, we need another agency, an agency that brings these all together and that can kind of watch them and work with them and overlook their work and try to bring it all together. So we have Homeland Security, and that's not quite enough. So we also have to have the TSA, and we have to have all these agencies all cross-checking each other. And all this time, they're not doing anything about the overseas threat. They are only doing something about oppressing Americans here in this country. And in addition to that, what are they doing? They're begging Americans to turn each other in constantly. We see the posters, we see the see something, say something. They're coming at us on the video monitors at Walmart. It's just getting worse and worse and worse. They're attempting to turn an entire nation into a nation of spies upon each other. Okay, now let's go back. You know what? Let's take our break and play our commercial right here. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from badquaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to badquaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help badquaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support badquaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? They're specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do you do? Well, you go to badquaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from badquaker.com. Thanks, folks. Okay, now, so we're back from that. Now, going back to Selene's Law number 1, this seemingly infinite regress goes on until every person in the country is spying on every other person in the country, or the funding runs out, whichever happens first. And since this paranoid and self-monitoring situation inherently makes targets of our own nation's citizens, the average person in the nation is more threatened by the massive secret police complex than by whatever the foe was they were seeking to protect themselves from in the first place. Now, we have pretty much almost attained that position, where we are all looking in every direction to rat out our neighbors. I think of, it's been said that by the end of the era of East Germany, or perhaps when it was at its peak, I'm not sure exactly when the statistics were taken, but the most common arrest made in East Germany at one point in time was for failure to turn in suspicious activities by another citizen. That was the most common thing to get arrested for in East Germany. Not that a crime had actually taken place, but the failure to turn in one of your neighbors was the most common thing to get arrested for. So are we headed for that? Well, certainly we are. Let's go back to the series on the inevitability of the police state. it's on its way. It's coming at us very fast, and it's because of Selene's Law number one. Okay, now let's go to Selene's Law number two. Accurate communication is possible only in a non-punishing situation. Now, what does that mean? Well, I'll read you the definition, well, my modified definition from Wikipedia. Usually, it is in the interest of a worker to tell his boss what the boss wants to hear, not what is true. In any hierarchy, every level below the highest carries a subtle burden to see the world in the way their superiors expect it to be seen, and to provide feedback to their superiors that their superiors want to hear. In the end, the hierarchical organization supports what its leaders already think to be true more than it challenges them to think differently. The levels below the leaders are more interested in keeping their jobs than telling the truth. Now, I've gone into this before with the structure of large industries and specifically large corporations, that within the structure of a large corporation is guaranteed flaws that keep it from functioning in the kind of a efficient way that a small company can function. And this is one of the ways. In a small company, the owner of the company is present, and the owner of the company has a first level interaction that cannot be duplicated in a large corporate scale. And so you do have, in a privately owned business, you'd still have Selene's Law number two interacting and sort of limiting what the owner manager can learn from his employees. But he has a much better connection to the business itself because he's right there in it. When you have a large corporation style of a business and you have layers and layers of managers and bosses of different kinds until you finally get to the top, then what you have is a series of one-way communications. Very few people have the boldness to tell their boss the absolute truth, and very few bosses will tolerate being told the absolute truth. So within this structure, you have a guaranteed layer, as many layers as there are in a particular industry or in a particular corporation. As many layers as there are, you have that many layers of blunder, of passing on bad information up the ladder. And more so when you turn that on government, when you realize that government, the bureaucracies of government, are very, very similar to those in corporations, except you lack a lot of the disciplinary options that exist in a corporation. Once you get into government and you have all of the inherent insulation that prevents punishment to the individual state worker, once you factor all that in, there becomes Selene's Law number two echoes louder and louder as you move up through the ranks within government, so that the people at the top never have a very realistic vision at all of what real life is like out among the citizenry. Now, an example of this on a smaller level is with a parent-child situation. The child, assuming the child is not in a rebellion mode at this particular moment, a child will often try desperately to say whatever it is that the child perceives will please the parent. And because in most cases the child is desperately trying to win the favor of the parent. So you can't get, even though people say that, you know, out of the mouths of babes, and you think that the truth is coming out of children, and it does to a certain extent, that kids will just pop off the top of their head with something that they haven't really thought through, or some clear and obvious thought that appears to them, and so you get these sparkles of truth that come out of them like that. But oftentimes when a child is directly interacting with a parent, they're seeking a way to say what the parent wants, what they perceive the parent wants to hear. And the more so as this goes out into business or into government. Going back to Wikipedia's statement on it, and again, I took their statement and modified it a bit, this third law seems preposterous at first thought. But the logic goes like this. While a dishonest politician is interested only in bettering his own lot through abusing the public trust, an honest politician is far more dangerous, since he is honestly interested in bettering society through political action, and that means writing and implementing more and more laws with good intentions and bad repercussions. Now, there is an exception to this, and you might call that the Ron Paul factor. An honest politician who seeks to improve the performance of government by abandoning some laws and reversing some of the effects of the first law, of Stalin's first law. The problem becomes that you have a more lean and efficient government to inflict tyranny once that honest politician is gone. So now let me just recap the law itself without the Ron Paul factor. Again, it goes, an honest politician is a national calamity. And the reason why is because a dishonest politician, you know he's dishonest. You know he's there to line his pockets. You know he's just there to get what he can, and he's there to pump up his own power and to fluff his own ego. And, of course, like I said, to fill his pockets in the meantime. But the dishonest politician is far more dangerous because he really thinks he's doing good. And in doing good, he wants to pass more and more busybody laws and do-gooder laws. And in doing this, a Bastiat's law, that which is seen and that which is not seen, he ends up doing far more damage than he has the intelligence to perceive. Because there is that which is seen. That's what he's trying to accomplish with his law. But then there's that which is unseen. There is the blowback to the stupid law that he passed. You see, any time government takes an action, there's an immediate action, and as Bastiat said, if that immediate action appears to be good, then there's going to be a long-term action that's going to be far worse than if there had never been a law to begin with. That's the concept of that which is seen and that which is not seen. That's the concept of blowback. And that's what happens when do-gooder politicians go and stick their nose in and start fiddling around with laws, giving us more and more layers of behavioral control. However, let's go back to the Ron Paul factor. But that's not what Ron Paul wants to do. Ron Paul and, you know, the few politicians that are like him go into government without the possibility of being corrupted by the desires and the egos and all those kind of things. And instead of wanting to do good by adding a bunch of behavioral controls through the force of law, they actually start repealing laws. And they actually start to shrink the power and the influence of government. And they actually start to bring this thing and make it leaner and more efficient, start to work it within its budget so that it's not being such a burden onto the public to finance this giant behemoth. But now there's a real problem with that, and I've referred to this before. Let's think of it this way. Let's say you're walking along down the sidewalk, and a robber gets the drop on you before you realize that he's got a gun stuck in your face, and he's barking orders at you. He's telling you to give him your wallet right now. Give him your watch. Give him your valuables, and you're not moving quick enough for him. And he pulls the trigger. Now, at this key moment, at this critical moment, his gun jams. And you look in his eyes, and he looks in your eyes. And in this awkward moment, you say to him, "Oh, I see your gun jammed. I know exactly how to fix that. May I?" And you take his gun, and you clear it, and you fix the jam, and you reload it, and you hand it back to him. That's not a wise thing to do. Yet, when we take this ugly monster, this hideous beast that has grown out of control in Washington, and we say, "Hey, we got a guy here that knows exactly how to fix you and make you work. He'll make you run like a top. here's Ron Paul. He can come in. He can fix your budget problems. He can stop the empire building. He can bring the troops back home. He can do all these wonderful things so that government can run efficient and everything's going to be great. The economy will turn around. More money than ever will be actually, I mean, if Ron Paul had his way, there would actually be a lot more taxes coming into the government because the government would run more efficiently. Therefore, it would oppress people less. There would be a huge economic boom. And with that economic boom would come more economic activity that would stimulate the economy to the point of where it would bring more and more funding into government than what it currently has. So all that stuff would be great, except here's the problem. Ron Paul's not going to be president forever. Ron Paul's not even going to live forever. At some point, Ron Paul won't be in charge of the thing. And now you have this same ugly, monstrous, hideous beast in Washington, D.C., except Ron Paul fixed it. He cleared that jam, and he handed right back into the hands of the beast a loaded, cocked, fully functional pistol. Thank you. Wouldn't that be smart? So that's the Ron Paul factor in number three of the Selene's Law. And that's not Robert Anton Wilson's view of it. That's my view of it. That's my twist on Selene's Law. But now I did want to talk about this a little bit because every time I talk about Ron Paul, there's confusion. And people think I hate Ron Paul, or people think, well, I just don't understand Ron Paul. Or they think, well, you just haven't heard this person's argument, or you haven't heard that person. You need to talk to this guy, or you need to talk to that guy. And none of those people are addressing the simple thing that I'm saying. And so what I want to do now is I want to run down some of the ways to look at the Ron Paul problem, the Ron Paul factor. We have what might be called the anarchist argument. The anarchist argument would be with the problem with voting. The consistent anarchist, whether they be an anarcho-capitalist or an anarcho-socialist, the consistent anarchist who adheres to the non-aggression principle or the zero-aggression principle, if they consistently adhere to that, then as you play out the logic, then you come to a position of where any form of democracy, if it relies upon aggression, any form of democracy, and therefore any form of voting, any government, any organization that depends upon aggression, the actual act of voting is an act of aggression. So, for example, let's say if you vote for a politician, even a good politician, bad politician, doesn't matter. If you vote for a politician, in the current system that we have, where all governments are based on a monopoly of violence within a geographic region, that's using the state as the form of government. When you have that, when you have a government that is based on the state, a government based on a monopoly of violence within a geographical region, that government funds itself entirely through aggression. Now, this can be aggression in the form of devaluing people's money. That's a form of theft. We know it's a form of theft because the government itself prosecutes counterfeiting because counterfeiting is theft. And yet when the government does it, it's just how the government funds itself. So a government funds itself through either the publishing of money, the printing of money, which is counterfeiting, which is theft, or through direct taxation, which is theft. It's based on aggression. They don't do it voluntarily. Or any other way of taxation where it's hidden into different layers of purchases or different layers of manufacturing. Either way, we're using deception and aggression in order to accomplish the taxation. Now, as far as the individual politician goes, the politician finances, especially here in the U.S., I'm not saying how it is in every other country in the world, but in the U.S. this is how it's done. Politicians get a large portion of their funding to perpetuate their candidacy and to continue running each year through way of their office budget. part of their budget goes to their campaign. Now, it doesn't go directly to their campaign, but they're able to use their office to put out newsletters and to collect email addresses and mailing addresses and all these kind of things that they later use in their campaigns. So one way or the other, taxation goes directly into the voting system. And taxation funds every action that the politician does. If the politician, if he chooses to do anything in the course of his office, it has to be funded. Everything he does has to be funded. And where does that funding come from? It comes from taxation. So everything the politician does, whether the act itself is good or the act is bad, it is funded by way of aggression. Now that is the anarchist argument. Therefore, if every act that the politician does is funded by aggression, then when you pick the politician or attempt to pick a politician to represent you, you are authorizing that politician or potential politician to commit an act of aggression on your behalf. And to commit an act of aggression on your behalf is the same as committing the act of aggression. So therefore, the act of voting in a current system like we have is an act of aggression. Now, if you have an entirely voluntary system where all funding is voluntary and all participation in the system is voluntary, and you have a means of escaping the system if you so choose, and then you have a vote, then there's nothing inherently wrong with a vote as long as it's based on voluntarism. But our system is not based on voluntarism. It is entirely funded through aggression. Therefore, every act of the government is aggression. Every act of every individual politician is aggression. Every act to select a politician to act is an act of aggression. That's the basic anarchist argument. That's not the argument that many libertarians fall back on. Some of the libertarians, particularly those of the Cato Institute type, that flavor, or the Reason Magazine type, many of those types of libertarians have a completely different argument. They do not go with the anarchists' argument about voting. As a matter of fact, Cato works hand in hand with the government on many things, on many different projects attempting to bend the government towards the libertarian ways. And the same way with Reason Magazine. I've never seen anybody at Reason or at Cato make the argument that voting in and of itself is immoral or against the zero aggression principle. So the Cato Reason type libertarian has other reasons that they may not support Ron Paul, although some at the Cato Institute do support Ron Paul and some at Reason Magazine support Ron Paul. But the basic libertarian argument coming from people like that is that either Ron Paul himself is flawed or his message is flawed. So now I want to cover both of these for you so that we know the arguments. Now, I'm not saying this is my argument. I'm saying that this is their argument. Here's the first argument. Ron Paul himself is flawed. Now they can use several things to explain this argument. One, the very common thing that they always kick around is those old newsletters. That's always going to be there. There's always going to be somebody that's going to bring that up at some point in time. How that will play out in the public, no one has any way of knowing. I did a whole nother podcast on that back in December, and I pointed out that the best way to handle any kind of family secret is to get it out in the open as quick as possible, and the longer you hide it, the worse it's going to get. So using that train of thought, it would have been better to have the Ron Paul newsletters completely exposed and the author outed, you know, years ago. It would have been better in December. It would have been better yesterday than today. It would be better today than tomorrow. And it would be better tomorrow than next week. The quicker that's dealt with, the better. But who knows if that'll ever really become a big problem of any kind. Some people are very worried about that. Ron Paul doesn't seem to be. So we can set that aside. Now, there's another problem with Ron Paul himself. And I've kind of made this argument a little bit, but I haven't really emphasized it. I have played around with it a little bit, and I mentioned it in a couple podcasts. But let me lay out this argument. Well, let's do it this way. You think about how many times Ron Paul has been on Jon Stewart's TV show. And you think about if you watch Jon Stewart and you listen to what he says, he is so close to becoming a libertarian. He's got a grasp on 98% of it, but he just can't let go of that last 2% of being a liberal. And he's brought this up to Ron Paul, and he's given Ron Paul direct questions, softball questions, that he has tossed to Ron Paul in an almost a way like saying, please, please just answer this for me and allow me the excuse to become a libertarian. And Ron Paul just ignores the pitch or swings and misses. Or, you know, I've gone through that before on one of the podcasts where I actually took apart a Ron Paul interview with Jon Stewart and showed where Ron Paul could have said just some very basic libertarian stuff, and it would have just left Jon Stewart in a position where he would almost, if he's honest, he would almost have to accept libertarianism. But Ron Paul didn't do that. And this is the flaw. If you see Ron Paul, he gets on any of these major news programs, and they'll say something like, they'll throw him a softball pitch. They'll say, well, now, will your libertarian message ring forth with the voters? And Ron Paul will immediately shift away from the, quote, libertarian message and call himself a conservative, and he'll start talking in that direction rather than openly embracing libertarianism, because so many people, even conservatives and most specifically liberals, when they hear the word conservative, they think of George W. Bush or they think of Papa Bush. This is what they think of when they think of conservative. They think of Mitt Romney as conservative, or they think of, what's that clown? Oh, I can't even think of his name. Santorum or whatever his name is. That idiot. They think of that as conservative. Or Newt Gingrich. They think of Newt Gingrich as conservative. Well, in all actuality, somebody like Pat Buchanan is conservative. Pat Buchanan is a consistent conservative. But compare Pat Buchanan to somebody like Newt Gingrich. It's not even apples and oranges we're talking here. This is like apples and moon rocks. There's no comparison. Newt Gingrich is no more conservative than my foot is my ear. But Ron Paul is not a conservative like Pat Buchanan. But when Ron Paul calls himself a conservative in the eyes and the ears of all those people watching CNN or watching Fox or whatever, they leap to this conclusion. They toss Ron Paul in the bucket with guys like George W. Bush. Now, in my opinion, that's a major flaw on the part of Ron Paul. He needs to stand up and say what he is and be proud of what he is. And I think people would appreciate that. And it would give him the opportunity to explain what it means to be a libertarian, except, like I said, he failed to do that with Jon Stewart. Now, if you take the Jon Stewart example, you know, it would be so easy. If you take a guy like Stefan Molyneux or a guy like Jan Helfield, a guy like that, given the softball questions that Jon Stewart has thrown at Ron Paul, guys like Stefan or Jan Helfield, within 5 to 10 minutes, could have Jon Stewart signing on the Libertarian Party platforms. I mean, guys like that could lay out an argument. Now, I couldn't. My method is totally backwards to their method. You know, considering the way I end up doing things like this, if I had the opportunity to talk to Jon Stewart and Jon Stewart was to toss me these softball questions, my clumsy, hatchet method of spreading my ideas, I'd convince the entire stage crew to be libertarians, but Jon Stewart would want me dead by the end of the, because I would mock him and make fun of every answer that he'd give and pick him apart with dividing questions that would irritate him and make a fool out of him to his crew. So I'd have the whole crew converted, and I'd have Jon Stewart wanting to kill me. But, well, probably not. He's a very calm man, but calm in the sense of nonviolent, that is. Anyway, so So the Ron Paul, so there's a flaw in Ron Paul. He says things that the audience, that those of us who are in the know, those of us who understand what he's saying, we get these things, and he says these keywords, and we get all excited about them. But so many of the people don't understand those keywords, and Ron Paul doesn't stop to explain them. Because if you look, Ron Paul does a really good job in his books, but when he's on the stage or when he's being interviewed by a reporter, he just glosses over those things. Now, in a way, that leaves it for all of us to do the teaching for Ron Paul. Okay, now I want to move on. Ron Paul's message. Now, a second ago, I was mentioning that some people will say that, you know, like the Cato and the Reason type people will say that Ron Paul himself is flawed. He doesn't have the personality for this kind of position. He doesn't. He has the baggage of the old newsletters. He can't explain libertarianism well. There's all these things, and I attempted to make that part of that argument as best I could for those type of people. But here's the next problem. It's that Ron Paul's message has flaws in it. Parts of Ron Paul's message are entirely contradictory to the libertarian position. The most blatant of those would be his position on immigration. Now, he says that what we need to do is stop nation building, stop being police of the world, draw back our troops from all over the world, close down those bases in all those foreign countries, bring those troops home. All that's good. All that's very libertarian. We all agree on all those things. But then Ron Paul puts a twist into it that should cause every libertarian to just shiver and cringe. He says he wants to put those troops on the border and secure the southern border. Do we really want that? Do we really want to militarize our own border? If we go to all the effort of taking our own military away from places like the North Korean, South Korean border and all the other places around the world that we've got our military interfering in countries, we want to take them out of all those places and we want to pile them on our own border and completely militarize. That, you know, that's... Oh boy, I could take this in so many directions. Which is the lowest hanging fruit in this situation? I just imagine, you know, if you think about what the borders are like right now, and if you're not aware, holy cow, get to YouTube and just, you know, do a YouTube search on Border Patrol. The borders are getting crazy. The oppression of absolutely innocent individuals is out of control on the U.S. borders, both north and south. So to decide that we want to actually officially militarize our borders, how could that possibly be good? Oh, well, there's so much crime, there's so much drugs coming in from the... Wait. There are drugs coming in the border, so we want to move the military to the border? Is that the logic? Does that follow the zero aggression principle? Is that following Bastiat's advice? Is that not digging a ditch only to fill it back again? If you want to stop drugs from coming in on the southern border, packing it full of military is not going to stop the drugs. It's just going to make a militarized border. It's going to make a very violent place far more violent. And it's not going to stop the drugs. Because you can't. Prohibitions don't work. And now people are going to be saying, oh, but Ron Paul wants to legalize and Ron Paul wants to do this and that. All right, then be honest about it. Once again, take the honest position. Say there is no reason to militarize the border if you stop the war on drugs. Stop it completely. Cease the war on drugs entirely. Don't legalize it, tax it. No. Just kill the war on drugs. There should be no more laws about marijuana than there are laws about broccoli. One plant or another plant or heroin, poppies, anything else like that. behavioral stuff where the government wants to bring its aggression down on people for their behavior when they have aggressed on no one, is that's beyond what a civil government should be able to do. And Ron Paul should be honest about that, and Ron Paul should put the crime problem directly where it belongs. The U.S. government causes the crime problem on the Mexican border. It causes the drug problem. It causes the drug wars. It causes the problems with the Mexican cartels. The U.S. government is the source of the problem. Stop the U.S. government from interfering in private activity, and you defund the gangs. You defund all that crime in all the inner cities. You defund all the activity crossing the border. There will be no drug cartels in Mexico, and there will be no underground drug trade throughout all the cities with all the crime and all the violence that goes with it, if it is entirely, and if this drug war is entirely and completely stopped. Not legalized and taxed and given permission and all that. There should be no difference between any of these things and any other plant that you might want to grow or any other thing that you might want to ingest into your body. Now, I'm not supporting drug use. I'm not a drug user. Well, I don't know about that. I take some medicine now and then for my stomach, and I have symptoms of diseases that are involved in aging, so I take prescription medication for that. But as far as illicit drugs go, I don't use any of those kinds of things like that. So it wouldn't personally affect me in that sense. But right is right and wrong is wrong. And it's wrong for the government to do these things that it does with the drug wars. So Ron Paul should be honest. There's no reason to militarize our borders. As a matter of fact, they're too militarized now. We should get rid of the entire Border Patrol. Get rid of all of them. Okay, so, but that's not my problem with Ron Paul. My problem goes back to what I said earlier. Ron Paul is right on so many things that if he were given power, if he were put into the position of the presidency, he could make the government streamlined and functioning in a way that where for maybe generations that it could function better than it has for a century. Ron Paul could do that, and that's bad. We don't want a refined, sleeker, more efficient government to oppress us and beat us and kill us when Ron Paul's gone and this efficient killing machine turns on us. We don't want that. We want a bloated, ugly, filthy, stinking leviathan, which the stench of which goes out around the world so that all of humanity can see what the true nature of the state is. That's what we want. We don't need a sleek, well-running machine to kill us and oppress us. We don't want to hand the government, the robber, back a functioning pistol and say, "Here you go, Mr. Robber, now go ahead with your robbery." No. No. We want the state's pistol to jam. We want it to backfire in his own face. We want him to fail. We want the state to fail. We want it to collapse so that we can rebuild that libertarian utopia that I've talked about. Not one where everything is perfect and where everybody's happy and where sunshines and lollipops. Not that. That's not the libertarian utopia. The libertarian utopia is one where everybody's responsible for their own actions, both for the good and for the bad. Everyone is held responsible for their own actions. Folks, thanks again for listening to BadQuaker.com. Be sure and get over to the website and for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights. Go to BadQuaker.com. Thanks a lot, folks.